Cinemakers, Steven Soderbergh. This is episode 12, Ocean's 11 from 2001. I am Tobin Addington.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski, and this movie I love. This was the movie coming into this podcast I had seen the most of his, and I thought was my number one, but surprise of all surprises, I think I like Out of Sight slightly more than this movie. So that stunned me, but I still really, really love this movie.
Yeah, I think we're all in the same boat there, right? We're all part of the same heist here. I also love this. You know, it's funny, when this first came out, I was kind of against seeing it for a really long time. I fought it because I just wasn't into remakes. I wasn't actually, like, as deeply immersed into film as I am now. I didn't know about Soderbergh and a lot of the actors here. But once I saw it, I was like, what was wrong with me? I mean, it's just such a great time. And I don't think I ever, you know, actively resisted a movie since.
There are very few movies that I think are as fun to watch as they seem to be to make. And by all accounts, both what we see on screen and what you read about the making of this movie, they were just having a blast. And it, for me anyway, it totally comes across. This is one of these movies that, you know, in my memory, I think, yeah, I like that movie a lot. And then I turn it on and I just start to grin. and so it was really fun to see it again.
This is a movie that there was a quote I found online that said Soderbergh said that the film was an opportunity to give audiences, quote, pleasure from beginning to end, and he wanted it to be, quote, a movie that you just surrender to without embarrassment and without regret. And another thing I read that was, like, he didn't want anything really bad to happen to anybody. Like, this is a movie where, like, everything goes smoothly for the most part. Like, they run into hiccups, but, like, things are fine, and, like, you don't have to worry. Like, you just sit back, you're like, oh, these are all of my favorite people doing cool things, looking great, eating food the entire movie. I just love it.
Yeah, you really don't feel like there's any real threat or consequence. You're right, but it doesn't matter because it is such a fun time to watch. I kind of do feel a little bad for Benedict at the end because what did he really do? He dated, you know, the wrong girl, basically. Like, he took the girl away from the wrong guy and that guy came and robbed him. But everyone else gets away scot-free and, you know, has a laugh while they're doing it. And you're right, watching it, I never get any sense of, like, dread or suspense or any of that in any kind of negative way or anything. It's all just fun from beginning to end.
Like you were just saying before, Tobin, was that it's fun on screen, but also fun behind the set, that, like, they were playing poker on set. There's all these stories about who won or who lost. Apparently, Clooney lost something like 25 blackjack hands in a row. Like, something crazy. Like, there's these stories about that. Soderbergh wanted everybody to really get along, and so they, like, in their off time, they would just sit around Carl Reiner and he would just tell stories about, like, old Hollywood. I mean, these people are going to be back for two more movies. These are people, for the most part, that we've seen with Soderbergh already who will return to his movies. So it does feel like everyone liked making this. Everybody took less money to make this movie because there's no way you could pay all these guys what they make and still come in with the studio budget. The only sort of point of contention that I heard at all, or that I read at all about this movie, was that Don Cheadle is uncredited in this movie because he wanted to be above the title, and the studio or somebody was just like, no, like, that's not going to happen. So he said, just take my name out of it altogether. But then for Ocean's 12 and Ocean's 13, he's back for both of those, and he's above the title in those. So that was the only sort of negative, not nasty, but, like, not entirely like, hey, we're just a bunch of guys making a move. It seemed like that was the only thing where somebody stood out and was just like, I'm not happy with this.
If that's all the drama that's on set, then I feel like they got away lucky. They got really lucky because, I mean, they're filming all over Vegas and, you know, I just feel like a lot could go wrong at any moment there.
And you're dealing with a bunch of movie stars, right? I mean, the egos flying around could potentially sink this thing. Like, there have been a lot of big ensemble, get a whole bunch of famous actors together and you know, try and make a movie. And sometimes it works really well and usually it doesn't. And for whatever reason, the alchemy of who was on set and how the set was being run and the way the script is amazingly tight. I mean, this thing just flies beautifully, I think. And it's a way to sort of have a giant cast of characters, give them all the moments they need, and still somehow it all sort of hangs together and is funny. I'm kind of in awe of the way that they pulled as much of this movie off as they did.
Yeah, I also feel like at the time, now correct me if I'm wrong, but poker culture and card culture in Vegas was really like kind of everywhere. There was like poker tournaments on TV.
Yeah.
This kind of feels like it was feeding into that popularity a lot. And that's cool because a lot of this like Vegas culture stuff, like I ended up going like 7 times between 2000 and 2010, you know, like I ended up loving that place. And I think part of it was the allure, you know, cast upon from this movie. It was like, come to Vegas, it's fun and safe and, you know, pull off a heist.
I really wonder if this was riding that train or if this sort of helped kickstart that, because I was super into poker on TV and playing poker with my friends. And the two, like the really big World Series of Pokers were, I think, 03 and 04. In terms of like the boom going from 100 entrants to like 700 and then to 2,500, and like in terms of TV stuff. And then, you know, it might have stuck around for like a year or two more, and then it sort of really petered out. But like, I think this is either at the very start of that wave or maybe it helped kickstart it. But like, it's still in that era of like making cards and making Vegas cool and, you know, showing even before they get to Vegas when they're in Hollywood and Rusty, Brad Pitt's character, is teaching all of these teen idol TV stars how to play poker, and you've got, you know, somebody from Charmed and somebody from That 70s Show and somebody from Seventh Heaven and whatever. Even there, like, it's these sort of celebrities who want to get in on the craze. So I think you're right. It's definitely in that wave. It's riding that wave. I just don't know whether it helped kickstart it or was just sort of riding its coattails.
Have either of you guys seen the original Ocean's 11? But are you guys familiar with any of the original version?
No, isn't it bad?
They're paratroopers, right? They're like former paratroopers or something?
Yeah, and it's the Rat Pack. So it's like Sinatra and Dino and, you know, Sammy Davis Jr. And it's basically like these guys, I guess, are like the Rat Pack of today. It's just a bunch of really close-knit friends that were all entertainers. Those guys were all song and dance guys. They all acted as well, but I think they were all mostly known for singing. And they got together and they made like a silly heist film that took place in Vegas, rob a casino. Only then, like, you couldn't get away with it, I guess. So, and they don't really get away with their crimes in the way that these guys do. But yeah, it's not great. I just recall this one song, EO 11, that just gets drilled into your head. Sammy Davis sings. I remember Frank Sinatra's Crazy Sweaters. But I was just curious if you guys knew about it at all, because like technically this is a remake. I feel like it's much more of like an update.
Well, everything I've heard about it makes me not very interested to see it. I've never been moved to actually watch it. I think if I like I say, I enjoyed this so much that when I finish this, I'd rather go on to Ocean's 12 than go back and watch the previous one.
I think there's something cool about the allure of old-timey Hollywood, like Frank Sinatra and all those, like in this kind of movie. But there's also something I think even more appealing about like the glitz and glamour of like 2000 mainstream Hollywood that makes it better. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's allure to both. I think that, like, again, I agree with you, Tobin. Like, I love this movie. I've seen this movie probably 20 times, and I've never even thought about going to see the original. I would rather just watch the other ones. Even if I don't love 12 as much as like 11 or 13 or whatever, I'd rather see the people that I like in this sort of world that Soderbergh has made, as opposed to seeing a similar movie back in the olden days.
And then in a little while, we're going to get Ocean's 8, right? They're going to do a girl team doing their heist.
Is Soderbergh involved in that?
I think he's involved as like a producer, but it's supposed to be connected to the same universe. So they're expanding this franchise as we speak.
Which is cool because this has been sort of dormant for a while, right? Like almost a decade, really. So, I mean, there is like a cool thing. Like you have, I don't know, 4 of the biggest movie stars in the world, right? Like, you have Clooney and Pitt and Damon and Julia Roberts and a lot of other people on that next tier down. There's just something really awesome about that. If everybody gets along, both for the movie goer and also the movie maker, just like seeing all this talent and everybody's having a good time. And they know that they're not making something that's going to win awards, but they're still making a competent, fun movie.
This is more than a competent movie. This is a really, really well-made movie. It's that, as Mike was saying before, or maybe it was you, Joe, I can't remember, that he knows exactly what it is, right? This is a movie that is meant to be pleasureful. This is a movie that's meant to be light on its feet and just be entertaining from the beginning to the end. And I still believe, okay, so the heist thing, like there are things that might be ridiculous, like stealing the pinch and blowing out the power. Like there's ridiculous stuff. But I believe it in the world of the movie. And it's sort of grounded by grounding it in the George Clooney, Julia Roberts relationship. and that having a sort of a history and a context and them being having such good chemistry, I think, in the few scenes they have together. I think people assume that it's harder to make like darker, more serious, awardsy movies. And I don't think that's true. I think that this is probably as hard or harder to make than like a straight drama.
I agree with that. I think that there's like this mentality. I guess there's two mentalities. There's the one that's right and there's the one that's wrong. And the one that's right is that most comedic actors can do drama, but it's really difficult to find dramatic actors who can do comedy. And I think across the board here, everybody's nailing it. I mean, it's not like Andy Garcia has to do anything funny here, but he's fitting in a world that, like, he doesn't feel out of place.
Yeah, and he gets to be funny in a straight man way. Like, there are times the others are playing off him, and he gives, you know, he'll give Saul, he'll give, Carl Reiner the sidelong glance. Like, I don't know that I trust you. And given that Carl Reiner's playing the accent and the whole deal, you need that sort of voice in there. It's not a showy part in this movie at all, right? Like, it's the least showy of the – he doesn't get to crack any jokes that make you laugh because that's not his – like his point. But I think he does what he needs to do really well. But you're right, he's not funny, you know, he's not haha funny.
Yeah, for me, I think the scene that ultimately I was able to suspend my disbelief for the rest of the movie comes very early, and it's the blueprint scene, if you guys know what I'm talking about, where
yep.
Him and Rusty first sort of meet up and decide to do this, and they get caught stealing blueprints, and they just say to the security guy, we're just gonna take these home overnight, and he's like, yeah, okay. So at that point, I realized they have access to just about anything they want. They have connections everywhere for just about everything. So I was able to sort of put all that out of my mind for the rest of the film. Ultimately, for me, this isn't really a heist film so much as it's like a comedy. And it yeah. feels almost more like one of those madcap comedies that maybe like a What's Up Doc that Bogdanovich made or something, where it's just everything is manic and over the top. And this isn't quite our reality. You know, everything is pushed to the extreme. Like, you look at Elliot Gould, you know, he definitely just represents a specific era in Vegas, and like everybody is almost close to like an enhanced, almost cartoonish version of themselves. Like, you look at the twins, for instance, you know, they're definitely like this Tweedledee Tweedledum kind of thing going on with those guys or something, or like Abbott and Costello even. So I feel like Soderbergh sort of surprised everyone, or at least he surprised me in a way that Tarantino does a lot of times, where I'm sort of expecting this straight up genre film, and then I get something that's like very funny alongside it, you know, and that just helps it play so much better than as if it was played, you know, super straight like every other bank robbery or heist film.
The moment that gets me every time that it reminds me of that, Mike, that's going to have that kind of tone to it, is I think it's after the blueprint scene. It's as they're getting in the elevator, right? And George Clooney gives some little speech, and it's the moment in the movie where where the little dramatic speech rousing the troops
yep.
would
mm-hmm.
be, and then he stops yep. and pauses for a moment, and he makes some joke about, like, did I rush that a little bit? Like, I practiced, and you know, and then they get on the elevator and ride the, and it's just, it punctures that, right? Like, it lets you know this is a movie that's going to do both, because that moment could have just happened. That could have just been a moment that Clooney plays it really well, and I believe it, and then that they puncture it too. That's what I mean about this being more sophisticated than it seems. It's able time and time again to give us both, to give us sort of the heartfelt emotion, the Hollywood movie sort of moment, and then also sort of puncture it with humor. And that's hard to do.
I wrote down that, but my notes for this movie are just like lists of things that I love. Like, I didn't really, like, it's not like they're not helpful, useful notes for what we're talking about. It's just scenes and moments that I love, like including that. And I think that there's throughout the entire movie, like Mike was saying, not only do they have connections everywhere, like the fact that somehow Clooney is in with Bruiser, who is, you know, Andy Garcia's muscle, and that he's able to use that to sort of escape and help with the heist or whatever. Like, from start to finish, they know everybody exactly, which is so totally fine because everybody is super charming. Like, why would you not want to be friends with these people? But at the same time, they use that charm to basically get everything that they want. Like, whether it's Bernie Mac, rest in peace, getting a discount on the Vans through a handshake, whatever they need, they're able to just ask for and get. why would you not want to be in this world friends with a Danny Ocean or a Rusty who, like, are criminals, yeah, but they're, like, so cool. Like, they're just so cool criminals.
Is there such thing as, like, an anti-criminal or something, like there is as an anti-hero? Because that's almost how I take these guys to be. Like, you're right, they're the gentleman thief. You do it with a handshake and a smile. Like, we saw some of this, I feel, with Ving Rhames' character in Out of Sight, where he asked to help the old lady with her groceries and then kindly steals her car as well. It's best not to draw attention to yourself or hurt people if you don't have to. You just pay them off and explain to them it's for their benefit or something to that effect. And yeah, it helps to look like Clooney or Brad Pitt or Don Cheadle or these guys. Like, they could pour on the charm. And throughout this series, they each definitely get their moments when they come in and steal the scene or it's built around them. And it's just great.
But what's also really cool is that, like, yeah, like, they're cool and they're Clooney and Pitt and, like, it helps to look like them or whatever. But in this world, they don't get stopped by fans, but Topher Grace can't escape the club. Like, it's just, it's these little sort of reversals, right? Like, they are cool and handsome and, like, able to get everything they want, but they're still just nobodies. Like, I don't know. It just did all these, like, little decisions, these little moments that just add up to this total package of a movie that I just cannot get enough of.
Yeah, there's a real charm and playfulness to a lot of the camera work, too. The moment, as the team is all assembling in Vegas, we get this, like, montage around Vegas. And there's some helicopter stuff, and there's some stuff from cars, and there's some stuff just standing on the street, and it's all handheld, and it all has this sort of slightly off-kilter, just captured for fun. You're getting iconic scenery, right? Like, you're getting to see the big casinos and the fountains and all that stuff. But it's not like the overly slick, you know, CSI shots of Vegas flying overhead. And it's not the, like, we didn't have enough money, we're just riding in a car, swingers shots of Vegas. It's not even the rounder shots of Vegas. This is like, oh, we're just having a ball and let's run out and grab some shots of Vegas for fun. And yet it all feels sort of deliberate in a way. I'm not quite sure. But I think the time and again, the way that the thing is shot is as playful as the script is being with the actors.
Most definitely. There's lots of wipes and pans and screen flips and stuff like that. You know, like he definitely gets playful visually, too, you know, just to really hammer home the sense that like we're having fun. Like there's shots, like there's lots of long takes in these Ocean movies, too, where you don't really notice it because the camera sort of whips from one guy over to like someone in the parking lot, and then like it'll zoom out and it'll be Rusty and Danny sort of like talking while they're drinking coffee or something. That's kind of like that. So much of this plays out in like real time segments like that, I think really helps the comedy play that it's all just fast and loose, but never sloppy. We're here, we're capturing it, we're getting what we need, and we're not going overboard, but yet we're like, we haven't missed anything either. We can form this scene and, you know, we can do it with like two or three shots, and that's all it's going to take.
I think that the movie really benefits from being able to shoot in Las Vegas, too. Like, a lot of this stuff, like, there's some stuff that they built, but there's a lot of stuff is shot out there, and it just sort of adds to the authenticity and adds to sort of just, I think, the overall vibe and aesthetic of everything, that, like, the producers were friends with Steve Wynn, who used to own the hotels that they shot, they filmed in, and then Steve Wynn sold those hotels to somebody else, but the producer was also friends with them, and, like, they shut down, like, the garage, like the underground garage where they shot some scenes, and like even the high rollers that they use, like the parking deck, they basically have like really, really great access to Las Vegas and the casinos. Like apparently even had access to the casino's security room and security tapes. Like that's all like authentic. So I think that there's something here that is special in terms of just letting people play in the actual playground as opposed to coming up with something that sort of looks like, sort of feels like Vegas.
I gotta tell you, having stayed at the Bellagio a few times, like, it was really weird watching this movie again, being like, oh, I've walked there, I've been there, I've stood where George Clooney and Brad Pitt have stood. That was kind of cool, too. But, and then I think later on in Ocean's 13, they'll end up shooting at the Wynn, his new hotel, and they shoot up like a sort of hodgepodge it a little bit. They just like cut and paste, I think, at that point. Like they just get full access to Vegas in that movie. But that is really great. And you know, I'm sure everybody wanted to play along, right? It's like, why wouldn't Steve Wynn give them total access? It's George Clooney, it's Steven Soderbergh. Like these are Oscar caliber people, and everyone's gonna want to come to your hotel after they see this movie.
Yeah, totally. Like we've been saying, they're just effortlessly cool. Like, even when they're sort of being goofy, especially, I mean, Clooney especially is just he is so suave in this movie and self-deprecating, but still suave. And I think that, of course, this is the biggest advertisement for Vegas, you know, that the screen has seen, you know, like this is a movie that for all kinds of people. And I think that, yeah, it makes sense that they would have that kind of access. It's cool. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. That they had access to the security room and things like that. That's interesting to see.
Especially since I've heard, you know, it's illegal to steal shots on the Strip and around Vegas. Like, I had heard that it's, like, notoriously hard to shoot there. So, like, with that recent Bourne film, they did that crazy chase down the Strip and had to shut it down overnight and stuff.
Yeah, but, like, when you're dealing with Steve Wynn, who's, like, the most powerful man in Vegas, like, literally more powerful than the governor, like, he just owns everything. You know, if he wants you to be in his casinos, like, you'll be, you know what I mean? Like, he'll override whatever opposition there is to anything, just like, oh, yeah, you know, Steve and all your guys, come on in, like, let's have a good time. So this is another movie. I don't know if it would have worked well. I don't think it would have, because I like the way that it looks, but this is another movie that Soderbergh wanted to shoot in black and white.
Oh, wow.
I feel like we've had a few of those. I mean, he shot one or two in black and white.
He gets a black and white sequence here real quick. The first of the three stories that Elliot Gould tells him about the people trying to rob Vegas is in black and white. Right. So he got one little bit.
And the producers were like, well, if you can, like, significantly bring down your budget, like, we can do black and white. He's just like, nah, like, we'll do in color. It's funny that, like, we're 12 episodes in, and I feel like that's something that he's wanted in, like, three or four different things. Like, I guess he just can't quit feeling like he wants to make things in black and white, even though producers every time are like, nobody's gonna see this. It's just, it's a different feel, it's a different vibe. Like, I know why you want, especially as a remake of an older movie, just let it be in color, because I think it looks so great. Like, it's so saturated and it's so vivid, and it just, it worked. Like, the color is such a key part of this, that to make it black and white would have been a completely different thing.
He will get what he asks for and kind of pay for it when he does the good German when we get to there. You know, he'll get his black and white and he'll kind of have to eat that cake alone, I think. But you're right. Like, this to me felt like the color was part of the design from the start. You know, like, there's scenes that are all red. There's scenes that are all blue. There's scenes where, like, clearly certain colors are supposed to be keying in on, you know, like Matt Damon is on the subway and everyone's sort of wearing gray, but he's wearing the red hat. You know, like, there's all these little bits in there. So maybe after he just really embraced it and was like, all right, if they want color, I'm going to play around with it.
Yeah, I would be curious to know how deeply he thought about that. If that was this would be interesting, you shoot in black and white, and thought about it a little bit longer and thought, no, never mind. Or if it's something you really pursued, because I have a hard time. I don't fetishize black and white. I don't mind it, but I don't fetishize it the way some filmmakers do. And I can't imagine this movie in black and white. I'm very glad that they didn't go that route.
Because I think, like we said, like, you know, the color works so well, and so do the flashback. Not only, Mike, what you said about, like, the black and white flashback, but, like, every time that we're talking about something that happened in the past, or, like, seeing Matt Damon on that, you know, elevated streetcar, there's, like, that juddery, you know what I mean? Like, and that sort of is, like,
speed.
Like, that works with the color, too. But, like, I feel like if you did black and white and that, like, it wouldn't work, and just, I'm glad that it is the way it is, because without it, you know, it feels like you'd be taking tools out of his toolbox. Like, he's got so many toys to play with in terms of exposure, in terms of color, in terms of whatever, that by just doing a black and white, you're like, this is the choice I'm committing to, and I'm not doing anything else with it. So we've seen a couple different times, like, you know, he's able to do things with the way that he makes scenes or timelines look and feel that to make your whole thing just boring's not the right word, but boring. You know what I mean?
But if you're going to shoot in Vegas, Vegas is neon, you know, it's all the lights. Like, maybe he just suggested it as a joke to see if they were going to say yes, and then was going to be like, no, I'm just kidding. Like, come on, we're shooting in Vegas here. It's you know, it's a color mecca.
I really have no idea.
But, you know, this movie in black and white would, I think it would lose a lot of the comedy and maybe feel a little too noirish and just, yeah, it would be off tone for what we ended up with anyway. For something that he wanted the audience to just, you know, kind of like turn your brain off and sit back, relax, and just enjoy the show. And like, you're not going to have to think too hard, but by the end, you're going to feel like really smart because it's an intricate plot that is kind of easy to follow. You know, like, there's all these like other little tricks and tips that I don't feel would have worked if all the color was muted.
Another thing that he's done in past movies, though we talked about a couple different episodes, that he sort of uses again here but in a different way, is that non-linear editing style. But, like, it's straightforward, or it seems straightforward, and then you sort of understand, as Andy Garcia realizes, that, like, he's been watching tapes. And so I feel like at this point in his career, especially as we're going through and sort of paying careful attention to all the tricks that he's doing, both as director and editor and such, that I like that it's linear editing, but it's non-linear storytelling, sort of, right? It feels straightforward, but it's not quite. And, like, it works, and the reveal is great, and I feel like I'm still a little fuzzy on the exact timeline of things, even though they show you, but at the end, like, it doesn't matter. Like, we just know that the good guys got away with all the money.
Yeah, well, I feel like with them building the safe, the main thing he did for me with that is telling you, now that they have a copy of the safe, your imagination can run wild. Like, whatever they do, you could see them thinking of. So, for instance, like, the idea that is that they taped the heist and then run it back for the people in the casino to see while they're actually robbing the bank. And I think like that is just what he does, is like he introduces like the concept and then leaves out like what they end up doing with it entirely. You know, like you see them practicing in the vault and stuff, but you're like, oh, they're just practicing. But by the end, when you realize they've been videotaping this and trying to perform it and everything to fool them, you get it. You're like, oh, okay, like that makes sense. You know, like you might think of it immediately, but it's definitely within the realm of possibility. I don't feel like that was like a large leap at the end there. Also, it was kind of funny that he worked in videotapes into this movie, which is one of his staples.
And there are lies. There's not much sex. I guess there's sort of implied sex, but there are a lot of lies, so 2 out of 3 ain't so bad.
Another connection that I had seeing it this time that I hadn't thought of before, obviously it goes deeper than this, but there's a couple of really fun pair, well, three really, or two at least. Like there's the Scott Conn, Casey Affleck pairing, which is often played for comedy. Well, almost always played for comedy. And I think they are quite funny together. And then there's the two goons. They look like twins, right? Andy Garcia's goons. And both of those pairings remind me of the assistants in Kafka, the twins that he used so well for background comedy. Just like funny things happening in the background. I never would have made that connection if we hadn't been moving through the movies this way. That was fun to see.
So those twins were apparently originally supposed to be Luke Wilson and Owen Wilson.
Oh, wow.
But they both dropped out to do the Royal Tenenbaums, and Danny Glover was supposed to be the Bernie Mac role, but he left to do Royal Tenenbaums too. So this could have been, I mean, there's a lot of different almost coulda, woulda, shoulda been cast in this movie. We can go through it if you want it all now. There's a whole lot of stuff, because when you have a movie with like 15 main people and they're all like names, like, up. Yeah, there's a chance. But like, I thought it would have been cool to have two brothers in those roles, as opposed to just sort of two lesser famous family members. You know what I mean? Casey's got Ben and Scott has James, right? So like, you know, father, son, and brother, brother. There's also apparently a rumor that Ben Affleck is in this movie somewhere, but he's not. Like, he was on set, but like, it feels like the kind of movie where he'd be like in an elevator or something. You know what I mean? Just sort of popping in, but he's not. So if you think that, you're wrong.
I think, for me, casting-wise, like, I still want Matt Damon in this movie somewhere, but I just felt like his character may have needed to be portrayed to be maybe just a little younger. Maybe like, I thought he was supposed to be like maybe 21 or 22, whereas Damon looks more like 31 or 32 to me. And I thought maybe if Affleck played him and he played brothers with Scott Conn, that dynamic may have worked as well.
So that role, the Linus role, there's two other names that I have here that were originally considered. There's somebody that was like, it was basically written for, who had to drop out. They're both really big names.
Leonardo DiCaprio.
Nope.
No, I was only thinking, actually, Tobey Maguire this time watching it. I was like, man, I could buy that, but that's it.
So there's one that was definitely big in 2000. I think this other guy was big in 2000. He's definitely really big now. It was written for Mark Wahlberg.
No kidding.
Oh, wow.
And Johnny Depp was also considered for it.
Oh, I could see Mark Wahlberg. Depp is even older than Matt Damon, so I don't want to see that.
Right, which is why, like, I agree with you that like it sort of feels like it could be, you know, a Good Will Hunting sort of style Matt Damon as opposed to somebody older, but I don't know, like, he's sort of like, in terms of like the, he doesn't have like facial hair, I think they try to make him look younger, but
yeah,
it does.
Well, he definitely
like
passes
character
for his role in the scheme, you know, like he's supposed to play like a bank, someone from like the board, right, like the gambling board or something, like, so he's playing like a banker, and like he definitely can fit that role too, so I mean, that's well performed.
Oh, Mark Wahlberg turned it down to do Planet of the Apes, so that was clearly a good decision.
Well, and also that we are only 3 years away from Saving Private Ryan, right? Like he hasn't done Bourne Identity yet. So I don't think we would have thought of him at the time as an equal to Clooney. And I think now we look at it and say, oh, it's Brad Pitt, Clooney, and Matt Damon. And I think it was at the time, it's Clooney, Brad Pitt, oh, and Matt Damon. You know what I mean? Like he hadn't done what he would go on to do, I think.
Well, he had done Rounders by this point. He had done Good Will Hunting by this point. I mean, he'd been in stuff.
Yeah, Good Will Hunting, he was young. That's 4 years before.
Yeah, I mean, he's not superstar, but he's still, I think he's worthy of being above the title or
you
whatever.
You know, I like what they do with his character in subsequent sequels, so I'll save it for that. The character that I, on this viewing, finally admitted to myself that I did not really like was the Don Cheadle character. Maybe it's not the character. Maybe it's the performance. It feels to me a little bit like he's trying to do like Benicio did in Usual Suspects, right? Like throw in an accent just to be a little crazy, just to set yourself apart. Now, maybe that's not true. Maybe that was, it was all written that way, whatever, but it felt a little desperate to me. He's the only one who didn't feel as effortless, and I don't love him in these movies.
I love the concept of the character. It's too bad that they couldn't get someone from like a Guy Ritchie film, because that's what the character feels like. He belongs in like a Guy Ritchie movie. So I wish they had gotten someone from a Guy Ritchie movie who actually was British that could do the actual accent. I think he pulls it off. I think he's a fun addition, and you know, as the explosive expert and everything. And but that Cockney stuff does kind of wear thin faster than usual. Like I could go the distance with the limey, you know, spouting off the Cockney phrases and the cryptic stuff, but it gets, when we're pulling off this heist, we need like information, and you know, everyone else is being super clear and concise. It's like, get to it already. Like, just tell me what's happening in English.
Well, so first off, I want to say that we do have somebody from a Guy Ritchie movie. We have Brad Pitt, so that sort of counts, right?
Okay. Yeah. And it's funny because he ended up doing that crazy, wacky sort of accent in Snatched. Yeah.
Yep, that's what I mean, yeah. But let's correct that to Snatch, not Snatch, the terrible, terrible Amy Schumer movie from this year.
Oh, my bad. I didn't know that. I forgot that movie even existed.
Oh, that's bad. What's weird is that, like, Don Cheadle, like, went to London to study the Cockney accent, and, like, he speaks in, like, this rhyming parlance and, like, you know, the Barney Rubble trouble. There's decisions being made, and it does sort of feel out of place. I like it, but, I mean, aside from Reuben, you know, who's, like, this just over-the-top Jewish caricature, sort of, right? Everybody else just sort of speaks normally until Saul goes into his Lyman Zurga phase. I like it, but it also does sort of feel weird, especially because Don Cheadle, he has such a cool, like, cadence to his normal voice. You know what I mean? Also, apparently, I saw that, you know, he hated it, or somebody hated it, and he, like, I think Don Cheadle hated his accent. He wasn't happy with it, and he wanted to drop it for the second movie and the third movie, but the producers were like, no, you have to keep it. So, like, he knows that it's sort of, like, a weird choice, or that he didn't nail it the way he wanted to, but...
I think what it does to serve best, and Soderbergh's really great at doing stuff like this, but this might just have been a misstep, is like each of these guys are really quickly and easily definable. Rusty's always eating, and Cheadle's got the accent, Carl Reiner's got the hat, and you know, all they all have their little things, and you know, the acrobat, he's sort of like the Chewbacca, right? Like they all understand him, but he doesn't speak English. And so I almost feel like this is just, we needed Basher to have an extra sort of eye patch. You know, he had his limp because he's the explosive expert, but he needed an eye patch too, and so they gave him an accent to just be like, all right, even if he's on a walkie-talkie, we can understand who we're listening to.
Yeah, I think I prefer Don Cheadle when he's doing stuff more like he does in Traffic. Not that it's not funny, but that the funny is grounded in sort of an everyman kind of thing. So to see him put on a bunch of to affect stuff, that just rings a little hollow to me. I can sort of see him acting in a way that I don't with the other sort of more naturalistic performances here.
And going to Yen for a second, not only does he not, the characters, they understand him or whatever, but like, he doesn't speak English. Like, they just found him performing in a Las Vegas troupe, so they had a translator on set so that he could communicate with everybody, so that they could tell him what to do as an actor.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of cool. But what I also really like about his character is that he has, like, no lines in the movie, but he gets the one PG-13 F-bomb. Like, it's just, it's so fitting for him. Like, he doesn't speak English, and then he's just like, where the fuck you been? Like, what? Like, just so frustrated. Just, it's perfect. Like, I really, really like that. Like, everybody's got this specific part to play, and his is just, he can do this one thing, and then, like, the sort of the team lets him down a little bit, and he's just frustrated. So, that's great.
That's a great example of Soderbergh's sort of comic timing, too, is to give the one guy who can't speak English the F-bomb.
Yeah. You know who else I love in this movie that I don't remember? I don't think of it before watching it, but in this viewing, I thought Julia Roberts was wonderful. And in a part that's a little it's not quite thankless, but she doesn't get any fun stuff to do, right? Like, she gets to be sort of upset most of the time. And that's a hard thing to pull off. And also to sort of be the prize, right? Like, it's a little... And the Linus's line when she first appears, when he says, "This is the best part of my day." And she shows up and walks down the stairs. When he, of course, doesn't know, right? He's standing there with Rusty. Rusty sees her and is like, "Oh, God, now I know what this is all about." And then her scene, Julia's first scene with Clooney, they have such great chemistry, I think. And I love her. They have these quips back and forth, right? Like, now we are in screwball comedy territory, but there's like pain underneath it, you know? So she said, or he says, you know, asking about Benedict, like, "Does he make you laugh?" And she gets close to him and says, "He doesn't make me cry." And the way that she just sort of nails him in that moment. And we understand him and the heist and so much more based on how sort of beautifully she's playing those scenes.
And she had never met Clooney before this movie. So for the fact that
really?
They had such good chemistry that quickly, yeah. I like her in this. I'm going to like her more in the sequels where she gets to sort of spoof on herself a little bit. And we'll get to that, you know, down the road. But I don't want to say she's underwhelming in this, but she's such a force of nature in Erin Brockovich that it's like hard to sort of reconcile that it's the same actress in the same director's movie. She's not given anything to do here, so it's not her fault. It's just that she put on what might be like the best performance I've ever seen, and then here she's kind of like even more of a straight man than Andy Garcia, just with that like underlying pain. It's difficult to really give her the credit she deserves just because she's not an afterthought, because she's at the emotional core of all this, but like in terms of the entertainment, nobody's gonna walk away from this movie saying like, "You know who I really loved in this is Julia Roberts." Like, she was great in this movie.
Well, I think that's because, right, she has to carry all the weight, basically. Like, she's the only one, for the most part, that isn't running around having fun. Even Andy Garcia is running around meeting and greeting all the customers and going to the fights and this and that. And, like, she is waiting around for him most of the time and then at the gallery. It's kind of unfortunate that, yeah, she has sort of the least stuff to do just by virtue of her character. It's unfortunate. I almost would want her to be part of the heist crew and we get another woman to play her role, who's like sort of just because it's more subdued. But for what it is, you're right, like, she's an extremely strong presence, and I think that helps enormously. I feel her scorn, you know, and like, I know that she's pissed, and she's right now, she doesn't love any of her options, and she doesn't say any of that, right? Like, directly, but it all comes across. And so, for maybe a role that's this small but this important, I think they got the right person for it.
And you need somebody with a huge name, right? I mean, given that the movie is loaded with stars, you need a star to come in and play a thankless part. And the fact that she then is able to, with all these silent scenes or scenes where there's no dialogue, where we see her sort of, you know, trying to make this relationship with Benedict work, and it's just not, he's just clearly, they're not meant for each other. I just think that they play those very well. And I do wonder, though, how she ended up with him. How does she end up with Andy Garcia? You know what I mean? Like, I get that she's a curator, and if he is sort of modeled on a Steve Wynn type character, then he would have, he'd be buying all kinds of wonderful art, and they probably would have met before and blah, 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 blah. But I don't know how she has stayed with him as long as she seems to have.
He's as far from George Clooney as she could get. And so it's like, so he broke my heart, and so I'm never going to do that again. So what's the opposite of that? And then there's this guy who, like, instead of feeling too much, like, feels nothing at all and is more about the money.
Yeah.
He might not be as attentive, but he, like she says, like, he won't make her cry. Like, he's just sort of so neutral that there's not these, like, crazy swings back and forth.
I found, I was like, well, he's Danny's doppelganger, you know, like, he's the one with all the legitimate money, and he's the legitimate crime guy, and, you know, like, he can give her everything she wants, and she can kind of tell herself, like, oh, well, I've got this, like, the man in my life is doing this the right way. And they also kind of look similar. And then there's Danny, who does everything the opposite, like you said, like, he's trying to rob guys like Benedict to get his living and to earn his way. And this time around, I definitely saw that parallel for her. Like, she's looking at the two of them going, like, almost two sides to the same coin here.
Do you guys know who Danny Ocean was originally supposed to be? Who was cast as Danny Ocean before he had to pull out due to scheduling conflicts?
No. Who?
He appears as a cameo in 12? Bruce Willis.
Bruce Willis was going to be Danny Ocean?
No.
Yep.
No.
I could see him doing Rusty better than Danny, to be honest. Wow, I don't know if that would have worked.
No, because just George Clooney is just so good in this movie. And, you know, we were talking about during when we did the Out of Sight episode about how that's sort of like a prequel to this, and like this is, it feels the same way. Like, he's sort of a same kind of character, like just the coolest criminal, and in both movies he knows that the trajectory he takes is gonna put him right back in prison, or likely put him back in prison. He's still gonna do it anyway, and he's still gonna make it fun and still gonna get the girl, and I can't see anyone else but him in that role. I just love him in that.
Yeah, this is a perfect role for him. This plays to all of his strengths, from the self-deprecating to the suaveness that I've talked about earlier. There's also a tying back to movies that we've covered before, specifically Aaron Brockovich. This movie starts basically like Aaron Brockovich. It's a shot of George Clooney being interviewed, and we never see the parole board he's talking to. We just see, you know, these sort of ever getting closer shots of him as he's sort of telling him he's not going to, or being asked if he's going to offend again, right? And we're also learning about his history. We're getting exposition about him and about his wife and or ex-wife and all this stuff. And I think that that's, again, not something I would have noticed had we not been going through the movies chronologically, but it does bear a striking similarity to the opening scene of Aaron Brockovich.
And there is that, I don't know if it's a famous line, but there's a line cut from that scene that was in the trailer about, like, how much do you guys get paid? Which I never knew why they got rid of that, because I was like, that's such a cool line for him to say, just sort of him being like this wise-ass parolee, right? But apparently they found out that, like, if a potential parolee said that to the board, he would have been denied. So, like, they're like, well, we need to let him out. We need to actually, you know, get on with the movie. So I just think that from the beginning, you're right. We know who he is and sort of his outlook on life, why he's in prison, and his past pain. And we also sort of get a little bit of a flash forward, sort of. And he's just like, you know, she's not going to leave me again just for kicks. But, like, you know, now they're together at the end of the movie, so, like, maybe she will leave him again. Who knows? You have to come back for Ocean's 12.
Yeah, it was kind of funny to see Clooney with the goatee in the opening there. That was an interesting look for him, I thought. And one of my favorite details about Danny Ocean is that he was arrested in a tuxedo. And at the end of the movie, he was, again, arrested in a tuxedo. And so, like, he's walking out of jail in one, and then he's going into jail wearing one at the end. So I thought that was pretty funny.
And then also leads to the line that apparently Soderbergh improvised on set, that Rusty says, "I hope you were the groom." Like, you know, that actually brings up another thing that I read about, was that there's, like, and I think it's just good filmmaking. And again, before, when I said it's a competent movie, I didn't mean it as an insult. I meant just, like, you know, we're not making an Oscar bait movie. We're just making a good movie. Is that not only is it bookended with the tuxedos, but it's also bookended that the same song plays right before they hear Danny and Rusty's plan for the theft, and the same song plays when they're staring at the fountain at the end. So it's like before the crime, after the crime. And I just think it's cool. Like, this is a nice little touch that it's sort of compressed within this song. It's this one shared experience for these 11 or 12 or 13 people.
It's a nice symmetry. Like, even if you don't notice it, you feel it. It feels like this is very well constructed. And that's amazing. Like, I almost wonder if they were like, okay, we're just going to have some fun, that the pressure was off, and that they were able to really just come up with lots of fun, cool things to do, and that, like, ideas would just pop in, and everyone was on, for the most part, it seems like everyone was on the same page. So it's just so good, because you also hear of times where this just goes tragically wrong. We may or may not get there in this series. I personally don't think we get that far. But, you know, there's other times where you hear people in the making of the movie and they're like, oh, it was the best. It was like being at camp and this and that. And then you see the movie and you're like, well, it should have felt
fun,
like you're making a movie, you know? Like, right. Like, why don't you do your job next time? But good for these guys to be able to work and play at the same time and produce something, like, really good.
I do remember an interview from the time the movie was coming out where I think it was Clooney telling the story that he and Damon were out playing poker really, really late and getting pretty drunk. And then we looked at their watch and realized they had to be, like, on set in like 3 hours. So they went up to their rooms and went to sleep and then came back down and looked at each other and said, "I don't feel hungover, do you?" And he said, "No, I don't either." And then an hour later, they realized it's because they were still drunk. I would love to know what scene they were shooting at that moment. Anyway, it does sound like it was a fun time. And, you know, we've seen Soderbergh go through the trajectory of his career where he comes out of the gate strong and then makes some, in his mind, missteps and then reinvents himself through Schizopolis and Out of Sight and Aaron Brockovich and Traffic, allowing more and more freedom within the making of the movie, playing with improv, trusting his instincts in a way. And I think that totally pays off here. I think you get this movie to the caliber that it is in the way it was made because Soderbergh had done what he'd done before.
Yeah, cause there's a lot of notes on IMDb about how much was improv, both lines and jokes and sort of gestures, like when Basher pulls the pinch and like he sort of like covers his balls and sort of turns away a little bit. You know what I mean? Like that was improv. And so like there's a real sense that he's letting them play, but also he knows when that's going to work and when that's not going to work. And it's not like a guy making his first or second or third movie. Like, this is the 12th thing that we're covering. You know, it's at least his 10th movie, if not his 11th movie, right? So he's been around sets for a while. He knows when stuff's going well. And he also, I think, feels that responsibility that this is a really big budget movie. I'm not going to screw around. I'm going to let people have fun and make the choices they want to make. But if things get out of hand, like, let's reel it in. But it does work, and it feels light and fun and great.
It just seems like he's supremely confident at this point to make anything. And, you know, to pull this off, like all the egos we mentioned and just all the logistics and all the permission and all of the pleasing of the studio, and just to do that and to also produce something like you're proud of, that you want out there and that the public love. Like, he's just like at the top of his game, I feel, at this point, you know, coming off of stuff like the double whammy, I guess, of Brockovich and Traffic, and then sort of developing the newish kind of running gun sort of style for a while, like definitely applying that to this and then mixing it with tracking shots and every trick in the book almost, right? Like, it feels like he's gone back into that box and like he's using all the tricks he pulls off and starts using in Schizopolis, but here he's applying all of that to like a major motion picture.
And for further proof, I think, which sort of ties in with this, it's just mostly something that I just want to talk about because I love it in the movie, that they did work on set, is that the reason why Brad Pitt is eating throughout this entire movie is that apparently they were working so hard, working such long hours, that they didn't even have a chance to like stop and break to eat. And so he was just grabbing and just scarfing something down at the end of the day and was like, hey, you know, like these guys, like the characters in the movie are working so hard and doing so much that whenever they have a down moment at all, they'd probably be stuffing their face with something too. So he decided that like basically whenever he's standing waiting for something, he's eating nachos or he's eating buffalo wings or he's eating a lollipop or whatever. Like he eats like 8 or 9 different things in this movie just because those are the only moments of downtime as they're planning this elaborate, elaborate heist.
Two of my favorite things he consumes, one is a Red Bull. I don't even know if that's still on the market or not, but I remember Red Bull, like that was so huge.
Yeah, they're still around.
They're still around? Okay. But yeah. Those were like at the beginning of energy drinks, I feel. And then the shrimp cocktail.
I have a good thing about that too.
He's cupping the shrimp cocktail. I'm like, that's just like people don't walk. That's why they don't walk around eating shrimp cocktails.
So they did so many takes of that scene. That's the scene where Linus is like, this is the best part of my day, and Julia Roberts walks down the stairs. They did that so many times that he wound up eating 40 shrimp. So not only is he eating a shrimp cocktail, but he's eating a ton of shrimp cocktail. So good on you, Brad Pitt.
Then he must have drank like 40 Red Bulls or something.
So this is a big thing that, like, I never really put two and two together in terms of what exactly it meant, but there's that long line where I think it might be in the blueprint scene, or it's around the blueprint scene, where Rusty says, off the top of my head, I'd say you're looking at a Bokesy, a Jim Brown, a Miss Daisy, 2 Jethros, and a Leon Spinks, not to mention the biggest Ella Fitzgerald ever. And so that was something that came, that Soderbergh and Griffin, the screenwriter, Ted Griffin, who wrote Matchstick Men, shout out to Cage Club, and also created one of my favorite shows of the last 5 or 10 years, Terriers. He and Soderbergh came up with this list, and the breakdown is that Bosky is Ivan Bosky, a big-time trader on Wall Street who got caught committing securities fraud. So that's Saul. He's sort of like, you know, an insider information bankroller. So that's Saul as Lyman Zerga. Jim Brown is the confrontation between Frank and Linus to distract Terry Benedict so that Linus can lift security codes, named after the football player. Miss Daisy is the SWAT vehicle uses the getaway car after driving Miss Daisy. 2 Jethros are the Beverly Hillbillies, the Malloy brothers. Yeah. So they're the hillbilly gearhead types hired to take care of Miss Daisy, distraction purposes and for general two-man work. Leon Spinks is the disruption of the boxing match. He's some guy who beat Muhammad Ali in a very unexpected fight. And then Ella Fitzgerald is the looped tape of the robbery, because in a 1970s commercial for Memorex, her voice breaks glass, and they say, is it live or is it Memorex? And so what's really cool about that is that they know exactly what each other means. And this other thing that I read was that Ted Griffin said that he loved movies like The Magnificent Seven and The Great Escape, because the people in those movies all had a shorthand that, like, they each understood each other, but no one else did. And so for Brad Pitt to say to George Clooney, this is what we need, and for Clooney to be like, yep, like, we're going to get it. And we, as the audience, have no idea what they're talking about. It's just further proof that these guys are super cool, and it's also further proof when they have the 10 guys, and Brad Pitt's got his head on the bar, and Clooney's just sort of having that conversation on both sides of the conversation, that, like, they know each other so well that, like, Brad Pitt doesn't even have to move or say anything, and Clooney knows that they need one more. I love their relationship. Like, I want infinite movies with just, not those actors, but those characters. Like, the way that they interact. I want to know where they came from. I want to know where they go. I want to know everything in the between.
Well, and I want a friend like that. I have, you know, envy of that. The ability to give each other shit and mutual love and respect and camaraderie. And as you say, my third note in my notes here was that the jargon is great. And the line I didn't write the whole thing down, but the biggest Ella Fitzgerald the world has ever seen. And you're right, we don't need to know at the time what that means. It's so clear that they know. It just sort of, it's a window into a much wider world. Like, they have such history and there's such context to their relationship and the sort of con world that they're involved in. And all you need to do is tell us that. I totally agree. I love it when movies do that. It tells us so much about them as characters. It's not just about what's good for the plot of the movie, but it tells us a lot about them.
Soderbergh in language has totally been a thing throughout all of his films. It's like screwing with the way people talk, not just Schizopolis, but like in other films as well. And I feel like he's doing that here again, and it's terrific. And it's like, yeah, they're talking in code, but we know what they're talking about to a degree enough to understand what's happening. Yes, there's definitely mystery to trying to crack what their code means and everything, but you don't feel like you're out of the loop. You feel like we want you to be part of the crew, so we're just going to treat you like part of the crew, and you get to jump in with both feet, and like, this is, we're not going to sugarcoat it or anything. So I love that about this movie. Like right from the start, even when he goes to meet like Bernie Mac, there's like an unspoken thing between, like, they just recognize each other, and like, since everybody recognizes each other, they can talk like they don't know each other if they have to, and they can, you know, speak in these cryptic codes if they need to. And it's what helps Brad Pitt get Basher out of being arrested for the bank robbery, right?
Yeah.
Like,
right,
it's just moments like that where it really pays off.
That was exactly the moment I was trying to think of before, that another way that Brad Pitt just sort of talks his way out of something is he's able to take a criminal who's handcuffed away from cops just by sort of sounding like he knows what he's talking about and sort of speaking that jargon like you were saying, Mike, and just feeling like he should be there, like act the part, really. And they're able to just walk the guy away. Like, it's crazy that that happens, but in this world, it's like, oh yeah, of course. You know, if you find somebody who has that overcoat on and shows what looks like a badge, yeah, he's probably a detective, whatever. He's probably with ATF or whatever he claims to be with. Sure, why not?
I love that moment so much. I would do the same thing that cop does. I'd turn over the guy in a heartbeat. I'm not going to argue with the guy in the trench coat with the badge.
One thing I do want to say before we get into more in trivia is that it takes a while, which I think is why it works, but when they're introducing the gang, after they talk about what they need and they sort of cut from scene to scene, and you have like Casey Affleck and Scott Conn in the monster truck and the RV monster truck and like all those different scenes where you get the taste of who they are, I couldn't help but think again, and I feel like every time we see one of these, I make the same reference, but like a movie like Suicide Squad could do so much better to learn from this. Like, instead of giving like 5 seconds to a character, show them in a scene, like show them in the world, show us who they are. And we know, like, it takes maybe 5 or 6 minutes total, but by the end of that, we know their entire crew. Like, we know everybody there is, and who they are, and what role they play, and how they're going to be a pain in the ass. Like, it's just great.
Yeah, the characters are asserted. You know, there's not a lot of throat clearing. There's no time for throat clearing in this movie. We've got so many characters to introduce. They just sort of show us, and that's the key, right? They show us exactly who they are as they're introduced, and it's just a model for anybody looking to write a movie with this many characters, or even like half this many characters.
The wig that Brad Pitt wears when he's the doctor was the Mike Myers rehearsal wig for Austin Powers. So that's a nice little thing. In terms of other Soderbergh connections, we said that, you know, all the actors obviously are back. David Holmes is back from Out of Sight as the composer, and he'll return for the sequels in Haywire. The editor worked on Traffic. He'll come back for the sequels. He'll be back for The Informant and Contagion. So not only is it people in front of the camera, but people behind the camera, he's going to work with them again. Oh, and the other thing about the music is that they wanted a song for Elvis that wasn't Viva Las Vegas, and so they did A Little Less Conversation, which was remixed, I think, by Paul Oakenfold, and then became like a really big hit that I've heard in a bunch of other things too. So that was a nice little, I'm sure that's the same guy who's composing, also maybe picking songs possibly, but it works really well.
There's one other moment, the last thing in my notes is a moment, I don't know why it makes me laugh so much, and I feel a little bad for it, for laughing, but I think we're supposed to. The lights go off, the power goes out all over Vegas, and then when they come back on, pandemonium has ensued in the, like, down on the floor.
Yes.
And we just get a few little shots of, like, people just going nuts. And there's this one, we have this tracking shot with this waitress. We're, like, moving left to right with this waitress. And she just gets clotheslined by somebody. And then it cuts away. Like, it's maybe a three-second shot, if that. Maybe 2 seconds. And it just makes me laugh so much. And then later on, when the SWAT team is leaving, everything seems to be back to normal in the casino. Like, everybody's sort of like, that's what this movie is. That's what it does. It does so well. And it, in some senses, you could guess that might be actually what would happen in Vegas. Like, okay, we're going to get back to business now. But the clotheslining of that waitress makes me giggle every time I see it.
I always laugh also when Lennox Lewis starts punching again in the boxing match. The lights come on and the boxers just go right at it again.
Pandemonium. A few other things. Brett Ratner was at one point set to direct this movie.
Oh, man.
So I think we dodged a bullet, even though we both loved, I mean, he might have been just coming off The Family Man, so we both loved that for Cage Club.
He ended up doing that Ben Stiller heist film. Was Eddie Murphy in that? Yeah, it was Eddie Murphy and Ben Stiller, and they were robbing Alan Alda in New York City because it was like a Bernie Madoff kind of situation. That, anyway, I don't think he was able to really juggle that.
That's the same writer, too. That's this Ted Griffin.
No kidding.
Yeah, Tower Heist, right?
Yeah, Tower Heist. All right, so he got his shot.
George Clooney sent Julia Roberts a copy of the script with a $20 bill on it, and he added a note, said, like, I heard you're getting 20 per picture now, because she had made $20 million for Aaron Brockovich, so what a prankster. Also in terms of George Clooney pranks, because, you know, famous on set for being a prankster.
Oh, totally, totally, the most famous prankster.
The most famous prankster, which I kind of love these stories, but I also kind of hate that, like, everybody loves them. You know, it's just this weird...
Oh,
but
it's total tabloid, like, People
yes.
magazine trash that I never want to be a part of, but I can't help it sometimes.
One thing that I read was that he and a bunch of other people on set would set 5 a.m. wake-up calls for Julia Roberts, like, total classic funny move. Just, like, when she didn't have to be up at 5, like, you know, making her wake up at 5, so...
That doesn't seem, like, funny when you're a working actor. Like, I mean, I could understand, you know, stealing the ice.
Or, like, the most famous George Clooney prank of all, I think, is, like, when he was house-sitting for a friend and kept scooping the cat's poop. Do you know the story? That it's something like he was cat-sitting or something, or house-sitting, and every time the cat went to the litter box, he would scoop the poop out really quick. And his friend got really, really worried because he never saw his cat poop that... the cat was sick or something, and then George Clooney, classic prankster, pooped in the box himself.
Oh my god.
So that's, you know, classic Clooney.
Oh my god.
I don't know when in that career, but that's like I think the most famous example of Clooney prankster. Jon Favreau was offered to write the screenplay, but he turned it down.
Oh, that's definitely off of his swingers cachet right there.
Apparently, Bernie Mac said that Steve Harvey tried to take his role, but then Steve Harvey later said that wasn't true, so I don't know about that. Ewan McGregor was considered for the Don Cheadle role, which I think could have been... I really like him on this season of Fargo. For the Reuben role, Sidney Pollack and Dennis Franz were considered, and then for Terry Benedict, for the Andy Garcia role, Warren Beatty, Michael Douglas, and Ralph Fiennes were considered, so... Michael Douglas could have come back from Traffic, but yeah, any of them I think could have been cool. I think Andy Garcia works.
Absolutely. Like I said, I feel like he kind of is like the Clooney doppelganger to me. Like, I feel like once they cast him and they got him both on set, they're like, oh, look at this. Like, slick their hair back, and they're both handsome, brooding guys.
And then the last casting thing that I think I saw was that the Saul role, which is Carl Reiner, Alan Arkin was cast but dropped out, and Soderbergh wanted Don Rickles in that role, but I guess got Carl Reiner instead, which I mean, Carl Reiner's just perfect in this.
Carano's great, but Rickles was in Casino, the Scorsese film, so that might have been a little too referential, kind of. Like, they're already doing jabs at, like, their real-life personas through the, you know, like, it's actually before, like, all, a lot of that was in, like, mainstream comedy, where it's, like, this self-referential, like, breaking the fourth wall without looking at the camera kind of material.
So Julia Roberts and Brad Pitt will return in his next movie in Full Frontal. And they also worked together again the next year, I think, in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind and also in The Mexican. So they were in like four movies or more movies, including the sequels, like all in a really sort of clumped little group here. And then did you guys know that Soderbergh is in the movie?
No.
He is... I don't know if he's the one who makes the error or not, but when Basher is caught, he's one of the guys robbing that, or, you know, the bank thief with Don Cheadle. He's, like, in a mask or something, so... I had to Google, because I saw that, like, the director's cameo was, like, a bank thief, and I was like, well, that could be, like, four different scenes in this movie, and so I had to Google image, and it's just some guy with a mask next to Don Cheadle, so... I don't know if somebody fell out, or they just, you know, he wanted to be on screen, or whatever, but...
There's something I noticed this time that I don't know if it was intentional or not, but was Rusty's tattoo, the tattoo that Brad Pitt wears, was that supposed to be a reference to Clooney's tattoo in From Dusk Till Dawn, that they're both like these huge full tribal sleeves?
I don't know. I didn't see anything about that. Maybe.
I almost saw it as a, like, I wear this better than
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
Moment. Like, you did this, like, like a few years ago, almost 10 years ago, like, I'll do it now.
Well, that's another thing that I read was that I think the two of them, and maybe at least one other person, maybe Damon, but, like, you have a couple of different people's sexiest man alive, so, like, who could possibly say that they wore something better than Clooney is, you know, Brad Pitt.
Right,
like,
they're on this movie, yeah.
Yes. I think that's all my notes. There was so much trivia. Like, people love this movie. People love, you know, finding facts about this movie. So this was probably the most cool, interesting trivia that I had about any movie for any podcast that we've done. But I think I'm fully tapped out on everything now. Toby, anything else you want to say about Ocean's 11?
Yeah, just two things. One, we talked a little bit before we started recording about how the movie came out in 2001 in December, that it was a sort of Christmas time release. And I wonder if how much of that played into not its popularity, but its success. Trying to think back, I just moved to New York just before 9/11, and there was a lot of questions in the movie business, like, should we keep making movies, you know, like this whole sort of crazy trauma response. And the idea that by December people would really want a high quality Hollywood entertainment. I'm sure this movie would have been successful either way, but the quality of success, the catharsis of this movie coming out so soon after, or within a few months of 9/11, I wonder if that played at all into how well it did. Do you guys have any thoughts about that?
I'm not sure. I don't know about that. I'm just looking. So the budget was 85. It made 183 domestic, but it made another 267 worldwide. So not only was it a hit here, but it was a hit around the world, which I feel like doesn't really track, because that's usually for, like, action movies. And, like, there's so much comedy in this that I don't know why it would be such a hit around the world other than just you have, like, massive movie stars. You know what I mean? So I think it worked. I think that it because it's a good movie that's sort of painless, I guess you could say, and easy fun is exactly what America probably needed, but also its success around the world is just like, I think it was going to be a success no matter when, because when you have this many big names in it. I also bought this movie, I think, three times on DVD, like twice on DVD and then again on Blu-ray. I'm just contributing to this movie's success myself, so I think it's just, you know, it was always going to be a success as long as Soderbergh didn't screw it up, or, you know, there wasn't massive ego battles on set. I think it was always going to be good and just came at the right time.
And films were delayed, you know, and this was not one of them. So I wonder if that was speaking to its strength as well, you know, like, it's just a lighthearted good time, you know, there's no real consequence here. No one's really getting hurt in the long run. And so, therefore, there's nothing offensive really about this. So, yes, it would have been a success anyway, but I do feel like the climate may have contributed a little more than usual, just making it more of a sensation faster, perhaps. I feel like it would have done well in theaters, but probably exploded on home video, whereas it exploded in theaters and then just, like, skyrocketed after that into, like, a franchise.
Yeah, the only other thing I wanted to say was, Joy, I was overjoyed to hear at the beginning of our conversation that you placed this number two in your rankings after Out of Sight. I did the same thing, and I struggled with that a little bit, but I thought I was going to get pushback from you on that, knowing how much you love this movie, but that's where I put it too.
I know. One thing I realized while watching this movie is how much of this I have memorized. Like, I have most of The Matrix memorized, I have a lot of Office Space memorized, but I didn't realize how many times I'd seen this movie until, like, I knew all of the one-liners. I just love this movie, but I think There's something special about Out of Sight. This movie is great and I love it, but there's something about Out of Sight that's just like, it just pushes even more of my buttons than this movie. It's really like one and one A. Like, I love both of them so much, and, you know, if I could make them both number one, I would, but alas. I've seen about half of what's coming. I wonder if anything else will approach that. I don't think it will. I think that what I've seen is the stuff that I'm more inclined to love. But I'm going to keep an open mind, and we'll see. Mike, do you have any other last thoughts?
It's funny, like, I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast how, like, I tried to resist this. Like, at the time it came out, I just wasn't in the mood for remakes. I'm still not a big remake guy, but, like, I actively tried not to see this until, you know, one day I just finally said, fine, I'll watch it. And it put me in the best mood, you know, and it really kind of changed my perspective, and it made me say, like, you know, don't shun a movie, like, give it a shot. And, you know, that was what, like, 16 years ago. I've always tried to see the movie before joining the conversation after that, you know, like, I didn't try and trash something before I saw it, and I feel like I might have done that with this movie. And I saw it and I just had to eat my hat, and I never wanted to do that again. And also, like, just the past couple days I've been going through some pretty tough screenings recently, like just watching some horrible movies.
I mean, you're going through tough screenings, but, like, nobody told you that you needed to watch all the Mummy movies leading up to the new Mummy. Like,
nobody's putting their feet
to the fire. And that's also another sort of spoiler for when we're recording this, but, like, you do it to yourself, man, and, like, just watch more movies like this. Like, I realized recently, rewatching, like, Wet Hot and rewatching this and stuff, that I just want to watch more movies that I love. Like, there's so many that I love that I don't know why I subject myself to go see The Mummy in theaters when I know that, like, everybody hates it, that you hate it. So not only do the critics that I, you know, admire hate it, but, like I respect your takes and you hate it. Like, why do I go spend 2 hours on a Sunday watching The Mummy when I could, like, rewatch Out of Sight or something? I don't know what's wrong with my brain. I don't.
And I think that's what I was kind of getting at, too, is after going through some bad screenings and then rewatching this, and, you know, going from, like, you know, The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, and wondering, you know, what is life, you know, does it even matter, and then watching Ocean's 11 and going, like, everything is right in the universe once again, it just a total change in my spirit. And it made me once again remind myself to just don't waste my time watching bad movies if I know they're going to be bad. Like, why subject myself to that anymore? And so I don't think I will anymore. I'm just going to try and watch movies I hope are going to be good from the start, and not watch things just because to be, like, a completist or anything, just to check it off a list, you know? I want to watch movies I like, and I really like this movie.
Yeah, well said. So for all things Cinemakers and all things Cage Club and Keanu Club and all of our shows, cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, and at cageclubpod on Twitter. We are available, all of our shows are available to listen to and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. So however you want to listen to us, you can. So go listen to all of our things and come back next week for more Soderbergh. And we've got Ocean's 12 in about 6 weeks, and we've got Ocean's 13 in about 2 months. So lots more of these guys to come. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I am Tobin Addington.
And we'll see you next time on Cinemakers.